The secrets to crafting a killer whodunit. What could be finer than a warm summer day and a good crime novel in your hands? Ever since Edgar Allan Poe and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle introduced the genre to Western audiences, its popularity has soared. Mysteries and thrillers account for about 30% of fiction sales today. What is it about whodunits that makes them so appealing? Have you ever wondered how crime writers get their ideas? Maybe you've thought about trying to write one yourself. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn from three successful Maine crime writers with very different backgrounds about how they approach their craft. We'll also find out why Maine seems to be such fertile territory for crime writers. And we'll learn how the genre is changing with the times. Maine Calling says the butler is innocent. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Done well, stories of murder, mystery, and mayhem can invoke feelings of dread, trepidation, excitement, and curiosity. Today, we have three masters of mystery here with me to share some secrets to their success and to offer thoughts on giving crime writing a try. With me in the studio, Julia Spencer Fleming, best-selling, award-winning author of 8 novels. Her most recent is Through the Evil Days. Paul Dworin is a best-selling author and editor emeritus of Down East Magazine, as well as a registered Maine guide. The Bone Orchard, his 5th book in the Mike Bowditch series, comes out July 15th, 2014. And Chris F. Holm is with us. He's an award-winning short story writer. His critically acclaimed collector novels recast the battle between heaven and hell as old-fashioned crime pulp. We invite you to join our conversation. What makes for a good mystery? Who are some of your favorite crime novelists? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today.
Well, thank you.
So, Julie, I think you might have the best name up for a crime writer. Are you related to Ian Fleming somehow?
Family legend is that we are, but I haven't looked at it too closely because I'd like to believe it, and I don't want it to vanish in the mists of reality.
That's great. Well, I want to ask all of you how you got started. And Chris, I understand you started early.
The first story I ever wrote was in about second grade, and it got me sent to the principal's office.
So what was in it that got you sent to the principal's office?
So it was a charming three-page story called The Alien Death from Outer Space. I believe it went something like, aliens came from outer space, page 2. They tried to kill us all, page 3. We fought back and killed them instead. I think when the principal called me down to talk to me about it, he was really focused on that impressive three-act structure and not so much the gleefully colored pictures that I had drawn, really wearing down my red crayon. He asked me a lot of really pointed questions about that story, what my influences were, what might have inspired me to write such a thing. And I think, from the lens of being an adult, I'm fairly certain he just wanted to find out if I was a sociopath. But at the time, I was like, wow, he's really into my story. This is terrific. And at the end of it, he gave me a Hershey bar and said, you know what? I really liked your story and congratulations. Good job. But don't tell anybody where you got this Hershey bar because they might be a little upset that I didn't, give them something for their stories.
So have you been writing ever since?
I have been writing ever since, but not for publication. I think for a long time it was just something I did in notebooks and was afraid to show anybody. Actually, in college, I studied molecular biology, and I spent some time in a PhD program for infectious disease research. I thought I was going to be one of those bug hunters you see in movies that like go get flown into the Bumba zone of Zaire when there's an outbreak. But it turned out it wasn't for me. And my wife saw that I was miserable in the program and said, you should really think about doing something else with your life. And I said, well, this has always been my dream. And she said, well, what's your second dream? And I thought, well, I've always wanted to write a novel. And God bless her. She actually encouraged me to drop out of grad school and do just that.
Sounds like a great woman. So, Paul, how'd you get started?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer. I always in fact, I know that almost the hour of the day, which was the morning after I started reading The Hobbit, and I was about 12 years old.
Hmm.
You know, prior to that, I was a fan of reading. I loved books. But it was the first thing that I'd ever read that made me say, you know, I want to write something like this, something that makes people feel the way that I'm feeling. And, you know, I was a omnivorous reader through my teens, and my parents were really nice about it. They actually gave me a summer off in my teens instead of having to wash dishes or do other kind of, you know, summer jobs that teenagers do to write. And, you know, but everybody kept saying to me, well, it's great that you want to be a writer, but what are you going to really do with your life? And that is a really good question to ask a teenager who wants to be a writer. I would encourage every parent.
Oh, you would?
Yes, I would.
You're not being sarcastic.
I'm not being sarcastic. You know, it's hard to be a writer. It's hard to get to a place where you can actually make a go of it as a profession.
So what was your answer when adults would ask you that?
I didn't have a good one. And, it, you know, as proof of my life, I think it took me a while to get to the place where I mean, eventually, of course, I ended up in journalism. And that is great preparation to write. The problem, I think, is that it becomes a trap for a lot of wannabe fiction writers in that, you know, the famous cliche, of course, is the newsman who wants to, you know, who always has that book in the back of their head. I mean, it's like...
Oh, and you cover stories and you say, oh, this would make a great book. I read the newspaper that way.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah, you know. So anyway, it took me a while to kind of get there. But in my early 30s, I realized that I had a job that had a 401k, and I had a girlfriend who became my wife, and I had no more excuses. And so I began plugging away and plugging away. And
so were you writing at the same time that you were working at Down East? Were you doing that?
I was, yeah, in the mornings before I would go into the office.
What time would you wake up?
I would wake up at about 5 o'clock, and wow. I'd write for a couple hours before I would go.
Good for you. And Julia, what's your story?
Well, unlike the other two, I was never, you know, I wasn't born clutching a pen in my hand. I didn't want to write. I just wanted to read. And I was, as I think all professional writers that I've known, a voracious reader. You know, my exhibit for fourth grade hobby day was a giant crate of books with a sign that said, I am a bookworm. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing I didn't get beaten up. It's probably because I was a girl. And it wasn't until I was a stay-at-home mom of two that I finally got into doing writing as a hobby. And it was online. It was for a group, not a mystery group, but a science fiction writers group. And I started doing some short stories and sketches. And I thought this will be a fun thing to do because I'm bad at needlepoint. You know, I did not expect it to turn into, but I loved it. I found it was really something that touched a part of me that nothing else had in the various careers that I did. And so I started writing my first novel, In the Bleak Midwinter. And it was actually the first one that I finished and then got published. And during that time, I did, in fact, go back to work full-time for a Portland law firm and had a third child. So by the end, I was doing exactly what Paul said. I was getting up at 4:30 and writing for 2 hours in the morning.
So you had three kids.
Yes.
And one of them very young.
Oh, yeah.
A full-time job.
Yes.
And you were writing. So basically one of the messages is, if there is a message of this program here today for all of you listening, is there are no excuses.
Yeah.
If Julia could do that, speaking as a working mom, that's pretty darn impressive, I'll say. So what does it take, in your guys' view, to be a crime writer? I mean, do you have to be a little warped?
I think you have to have the sort of imagination where you see something and your mind immediately goes to the worst possible interpretation. I live out in the country, and I was noticing, of course, after last night's rain, a lot of the snow has just, you know, disappeared and everything's sodden and soggy. And I live by the Saco River, and the river's boiling. It's very, very high. And I'm driving back from dropping off my husband at the elementary school where he works, and I'm thinking, you know, the bodies would really just be coming out now. And then I started thinking, well, what if somebody had been hidden in a culvert under the snow and then they got washed down the Saco River? And this is just a morning drive home.
Just daydreaming a little yeah, bit. Uh-huh. What about you guys?
Well, I think you hit on something really interesting. It's all about the what ifs. I think yeah. we all have this inherent ability for storytelling when we're young. We're always spinning these tales of imagination in our heads. What if this happened? What if that happened? And I think that sometimes dies on the vine as you get older and you stop playing make-believe. I think writers need to be able to indulge their what ifs. And from me, it's usually not a scenario like you were talking about with this culvert and a body. It's usually a character. In fact, I happen to know that MPBN tweeted a story earlier today about a man who was pulled over with a car full of marijuana, which he claimed was not his because the car was stolen. I want to know more about that guy. I want to write like a comedic crime caper involving that guy. That just, you know, it sends you spinning. Like, what makes you think that that's a good idea when you get pulled over by the cops that your defense is, hey, these
trucks
are mine.
I stole the car. And Paul, what about you? What do you think it takes?
Well, I think it takes sort of one of two things. One, it's either an association with the impulse to commit a crime. So you feel so angry that you can imagine what it might be like to do violence to somebody, or a real thirst for justice. You see something in the news, you see something around you, and you want to make it right. And you can kind of associate yourself with the people in the world who have those jobs. And what's really strange, I think, is that the best crime writers, in my opinion, can access both of those emotions so that you can kind of understand what it is, what drives people to commit crimes, but you also can associate yourself with that feeling to restore order to the world by apprehending, you know, the worst of the worst.
So if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us an email at talk@mpbn.net, tweet at MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. In doing research for this program today, I found a statistic that about 30% of fiction sales in the U.S. are mystery or thrillers, and they've surpassed romance novels. So do you all have any thoughts on what's going on in our culture that people would rather, you know, read about crime than romance?
I think it's an old saw in the mystery world that the reason people read mysteries and write mysteries is because they like making sense of the world, that it's a frightening place and that mysteries tend to restore order. I think that's a slightly simplistic look at it because I do think that there are a number of mysteries that don't so much restore order but sort of peel back the veneer of civility in our society and show you what lies underneath. But I do think that mysteries are a great lab for sort of exploring the frictions in society and sort of, as Paul said, the urges that I think people have both to commit crime and to sort of impose order and justice in their world.
You know, I agree. And I think that one thing that often gets overlooked is I think some of the most interesting writing exploring what our society is like today comes out of crime fiction. Mm-hmm. I think that people who write crime fiction are dealing with the economic ills and societal injustice and the sort of real gritty day-to-day hard kernels that are troubling to us as individuals and as a society. And we try and do it in a way that keeps you turning the pages.
I know you agree with that, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, the first rule of the jungle, as I always say, is don't be boring. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that doesn't mean that you can't deal with serious issues while you're getting people to immerse themselves into a story through characters and through gorgeous language and those sorts of things. I mean, I one of the best books that I've ever read about Hurricane Katrina is James Lee Burke's The Tin Roof Blowdown, you know, which would be dismissed by a lot of people. Hurricane Katrina is a horrible event, right? So you would expect that the only way that you could possibly treat it seriously is through some work of nonfiction or through some sort of literary work. Well, James Lee Burke is, I think is a literary writer, but I think he's also, you know, he's well known as a writer of crime fiction and thrillers, and it's a page turner, but it gives you an insight into New Orleans before and after that storm that is, you know, that is unsurpassed as far as I've read.
Mm. I was going to ask you all how the genre has changed. I'm wondering if that's one of the ways. Is crime writing now sort of more socially conscious than it was in the past, or has it always served that role?
I think it's very much more socially conscious than it is in the past. And that's something specifically that I write about. And I know that a lot of Paul's books deal with social issues here in Maine. And I think that a lot of times people who are not particularly up to date with what's going on in crime fiction think, oh, it's Agatha Christie, it's, you know, the vicar with the cup of poisoned tea and in the, you know, in the library. And that sort of fiction is a vanishingly small segment of what's going on in crime writing today. I think one of the most interesting trends that we've got is something that Chris's trilogy has been working in, which is blending different genres into mystery. You know, in Chris's case, it's how would you describe it, Chris? Like paranormal, supernatural mystery, ghost story mystery?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I tend to think of it as sort of fantastical noir, but I'll take any label as long as they actually shelve me in the bookstore.
I don't think you're alone in that. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll go to your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Goodwill, seeking solutions that work and creating sustainable communities where nothing goes to waste. Not a shirt, not a shoe, not a person. GoodwillNNE.org. And Mid-Maine Restoration, specializing in steeple and tower restoration throughout Maine and New Hampshire for over 25 years. Maine-steeplejacks.com.
How does a rational thinker, a scientist, a reporter, and an atheist explain a mystical experience? On the next Fresh Air, Barbara Ehrenreich tells us about the baffling experiences she had as a teenager, which made her look for answers. Her new memoir is called Living with a Wild God. Ehrenreich's other books include the bestseller Nickel and Dimed about low-wage workers. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, writing good stories of murder, mystery, and mayhem. With me in the studio, Paul Dworin, a best-selling author and editor emeritus of Down East Magazine and a registered Maine guide. Chris F. Holm, an award-winning short story writer, and Julia Spencer Fleming, also a best-selling award-winning author of 8 novels. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Maine Calling Facebook page. So far, this conversation is making me want to play hooky from work and sit on the couch with a cup of tea and read. Yeah. We have a tweet. The tweet says, I wonder if Paul Dworin's books provided the inspiration for Northwood's Law. Have you had has anybody said anything to you, Paul?
I know the people associated with the program. I know the producers and have become friendly with them. And I've actually was fortunate to go on a ride along with Chris McCabe one day while they were filming his segment. And, you know, I think that's probably for an attorney to determine. But I'm not it's not something I'm going to pursue. I'm thrilled, actually, that the show is so popular. I think it's good for them that my books are popular, and I think it's good for me that their show is popular.
You know, I was thinking about something earlier when you all were talking about letting yourself have a big imagination. What if a body floated down the river? Or what if I did violence to this person? I think a lot of us have this sense. We have these things pop into our head, and then we think, oh my gosh, I'm such a horrible person for thinking that. But you all are able to say, oh, that's a good one, right? I mean, it's sort of a different way of coming at these things that crop up into our subconscious.
Well, you know, one of the things I've always found fascinating is that when you get together with a group of mystery writers, we have, I think, a statistically improbable amount of stability and happiness in our lives. there's an amazing array of mystery writers, and the guys are nodding along, who have been married to the same spouse for decade, two decades, you know, and I think it's all due to the fact that you spend your day doing horrible things to people that you don't like on the on your computer. And then, you know, you open your door and it's like, hi, honey, I'm home.
There's a nice person on the other side. But, you know, that's sort of related to one of the questions I had for today is, how come Maine seems to be such fertile ground for crime writers? Because last I checked, Maine might have the lowest crime rate in the nation. We are not a state overrun with crime. Is there a relationship there, or is that just how it is?
Well, first of all, I think Maine's just a beautiful and unique setting. It's a very rich setting with an interesting culture. But I think the fact that we have a low crime rate actually helps fuel crime writing. If you're inured to the idea of violence around you, you don't pay that much attention to it. I think here, and not to make it sound like all crime fiction is very serious, there is certainly lighter, more comedic stuff. But if a murder were to happen in Maine, it has an impact. You feel the ripples throughout the community. And I think that's something really interesting to explore that you might not get if you were to set that same sort of a story in, say, you know, downtown Manhattan.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You guys have any thoughts on Maine as a...
Well, I think that the landscape itself is so dramatic that, you know, there are people that I think travel to Maine, obviously, every year, and they go to Otter Cliffs, you know, in Acadia.
And they think of pushing someone off?
And they think of pushing somebody off, you know? And it's an idea that never occurred to them before until suddenly this person's standing right next to them and they realize they could get away with it. No, you know, I mean, we live, I think, in a rapidly urbanizing culture around the world, and Maine is the most rural state in the nation. So, you know, it's this idea that the tagline for the movie Alien was, "In space, no one can hear you scream." And I think in Maine, it's sort of that same idea that, you know, it's like, oh my God, you know, I'm in the middle of the forest. Nobody will hear me if I scream. You know, I'm on an island off the coast of Maine. No one will hear me if I scream, you know. And I think that obviously it lends itself to great suspenseful stories.
Okay, opening the phones, going to Charlie in Portland. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
How you doing?
Good.
It's interesting because I'm both myself and my mother and my sisters read a lot of the series, and I just finished one of the most famous of Maine's mystery authors that most people don't know about is Jan van der Verding, his interesting cop series, which I love. But you were interested in talking about a crime in Maine. In my hometown, there was a still unsolved murder that a wonderful writer by the name of Rob Lee Wilson wrote a wonderful novel up called The Victim's Daughter.
Sanford.
And are you familiar with it?
I am. It's, yeah, Sanford, Maine, right?
Yeah, my mother grew up with Rob Lee, and a matter of fact, to this day, this murder is still unsolved. But it's amazing how he took the materials for that and made it into a fascinating, fascinating novel.
Okay. Well, Charlie, hey, thanks for calling. Could you repeat the name of the first – your call was a hard to understand. The name of the first writer that you really – you mentioned and you really enjoyed?
It's a gentleman who is a Dutchman who was a Zen Buddhist, and he moved to Maine, and his name is Jan van der Verding.
Huh.
He wrote a series called the Amsterdam Cops, and as a matter of fact, one of the series called Maine Murders is set in a small Maine town.
So why do you like crime novels so much?
Oh, if one thing, it's for me, is the things, the great ones, Travis McGee, Spencer, Chandler, Sam Spade, Lee Childs, Jack Reacher. Actually, what it is, it's probably atmosphere, but probably also it's a compelling character that you put in different situations and see what happens.
Mm. Well, thanks so much for calling in, Charlie. Going to Brian in Bath. Hi, Brian. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment about the crime that might actually be in Maine, possibly, you know, under the radar in some cases. You know, in our small, lovely rural state, well, maybe not so small, but our small communities, you know, we have a really large prescription drug abuse problem, and there is, I certainly think, a lot of crime that is sometimes associated that well with that. Like somebody who I graduated with in high school about 1 year ago got stabbed in his apartment. Not to prove anybody wrong, but sadly enough, I don't think Maine is quite the lovely little quaint place that it exactly was.
Now, Paul, you've written about the prescription drug issue in your novels.
Right. My third novel, Bad Little Falls, is set in the Machias area, and it's about the trade in illegal prescription drugs, OxyContin primarily. And in fact, there's another book out right now by a really great writer named James Heyman, which is also set in Washington County. And it's about the same subject, which is the devastation that the drug trade is having, sort of this under the radar drug trade that's having on Maine lives, you know. And I think it gets back to what we were saying before about crime fiction being social fiction, is that, you know, I haven't read a novel yet about the drug trade, a literary novel yet about the drug trade in Maine and what it's doing to people here. But I've written a crime novel about it, and I've read a crime novel about it too. And so I think that's the thing, is that there are subjects that you might think people aren't really addressing until you look to the mystery section of the bookstore, and there it is.
You know? Agreed. And I think to the caller's point, one important thing to remember is although the crime rate overall is low in Maine, per capita, crimes in small towns are more frequent than they are in some major cities. They just tend to be a different type of crime and a more insidious crime in a place where there tend to be secrets buried and things not discussed. I think the prescription drug trade is an excellent example of that. But Maine provides a really interesting setting because we do have these small towns, these people whose families go back, who have long histories, and towns keep secrets.
All right. Well, Brian, thanks so much for calling. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can email talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. We have a tweet. I'm reading it now. Writing is a job. How many days a week, how many hours a day do you write, and how many words a day? And also wants to know if you guys have agents. So so now, Paul, now that you're editor emeritus of Down East, how many hours a day are you writing?
Oh, God, I don't know. It depends on the deadline. You know, as I near my deadline, I'm writing, you know, 10, 12, 14, 16.
Are your eyes starting to see the letters dance on the computer screen?
The caffeine consumption increases.
He was chugging Red Bull before this.
So you must be on deadline, right?
Well,
Thanks for being here. Julia, what about you? How many hours a day?
I would have to agree with Paul. And I've got – I still have one kid at home. So, you know, there will be days when I'm doing mom stuff and I don't get to it. And then there are days, in fact, as I'm getting close to the end of the book, where I'll put in 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day, and push it. I do always say, and I think maybe the Grimes would agree with me, that it's ideal if you are a writer, if you can write every day or almost every day, because it keeps your head in the book, you're in the story, you're constantly churning on what's going on, even when you're not working on the book. So when you sit down in the time that you have to do the work, you're there. It's ready. The book is there in your head.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that. And Chris, what about you?
So for me, it's wildly variable as well. I do agree that it's best to write every day. At least I try to write a couple hours every day. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes I do write 8 to 10 hours. I can remember when I was on deadline for the third book in my series, The Big Reap. I had no idea I was going to finish the book on the day that I actually did. I wrote about 25 pages that day. Mm-hmm. I was in the zone. I've never written that much before or since in a single sitting. And when I typed the end and looked up, my wife had cleaned the house around me. I had no idea. And she looked at me and said, "Did you finish?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Good. Never do that again."
Did she give you a Hershey bar?
She did not give me a Hershey bar.
So, Julia, I want to know what your...
We all have agents too, by the way.
Yes.
You all have agents. Okay, yes. So answer that question. Julia, You mentioned that your kid, you still have a child at home. Mm-hmm. What do your kids think of your career?
Well, my my son, who's a freshman this year at Trinity College, is the only one who's actually read my books. They're a little bit too violent for my 13-year-old, who's the one still at home. And my oldest, my 21-year-old, who's finishing up at Smith, does not like mystery all that much.
Although, even though her own mother.
Even though her
where
own
did
mother,
you go wrong?
I know. You know, what can I say? Although I did have, she's got several friends of hers who read my stuff. And she actually came home once having had a horrible experience while she was still in, I think a senior in high school. And she had gone to a sleepover with a friend's house. And her friend said, "We're going to read aloud." And she pulled out my books and she read the sex scenes from my novels.
Oh, my children would be mortified.
My daughter came home and said, "I am going home to my room and gouging my eyes out with spoons."
Do either of you have kids old enough to read? No. Okay,
no.
Great.
Although I will say I have until recently never written a sex scene, and it's for the same reason that I chose not to adopt a pseudonym when I first published, and that is I need my grandmother to buy my books. You know, I'm from a big Irish Catholic family, and if they don't buy them, that's like half my sales right there. And I couldn't stomach the idea of putting a sex scene in front of my grandmother.
We're going to go to Alex in Milton Mills, New Hampshire. Hi, Alex. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. It's wonderful to hear all of you. I live in Milton Mills, New Hampshire, right on the border of Maine, and I think it's a wonderful place to bury bodies. But I did want to say that somebody commented in kind of a dismissive way about Agatha Christie. And, these writers, Agatha Christie, John D. MacDonald, Ray Bradbury, all these wonderful writers came before you. And I just think they need to be acknowledged as the people that helped you get where you are now. And that's it. And I have 50 acres if anybody wants to bury a body.
Alex, I was the person who said that about Agatha Christie, and I do apologize. I think the point that I was making ineptly was not that these are not good books. And in fact, Agatha Christie, I believe I'm correct, continues to be the best-selling fiction author in the UK of all time. And people still read those books, and they still love them. What has happened, though, is that the people currently working in the genre are doing some very different things than the sort of writing that you would read, back when those were coming out in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. The same thing with John D. MacDonald. And that's important because we don't want to have the genre be static. We want things to be growing and changing and people coming up and trying different stuff. When we started seeing women PIs back in when did Grafton first start? With the 80s, maybe?
Maybe
the
80s, the 80s. Yeah.
That was a big breakthrough. People said, "Oh, you can't do, strong. You can't have women with guns running around. Nobody's going to buy that stuff." And now, it's an established part of the genre. So we need new blood and new ideas and new infusions coming into the genre.
Alex, thanks for calling. If you'd like to call, the number 1-800-399-3566. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Revision Energy, a local business specializing in the design, installation, and service of solar energy systems. RevisionEnergy.com.
Next time, the really big questions.
You do not give so that somebody would help you in future, but for that person to help another person in a similar situation.
Is there really such a thing as altruism, or are people ultimately acting in their own self-interest? Join me for The Science of Sharing from Sound Vision Productions and PRI, Public Radio International.
And you can join us for that this afternoon at 1 o'clock.
When remembering is as painful as forgetting.
The tone was telling them that it's okay to go out and kill the neighbors. They will be doing a duty that is expected of them.
20 years after the genocide in Rwanda, there's a global village of survivors, a conversation with one Rwandan woman who helps hold them all together. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
The Takeaway, tonight at midnight.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what does it take to write a page-turner? With me in the studio, Chris F. Holm, award-winning short story writer whose critically acclaimed collector novels recast the battle between heaven and hell as old-fashioned crime pulp. Julia Spencer Fleming, best-selling award-winning author of 8 novels, the most recent, Through the Evil Days. And Paul Dworin, best-selling author and editor emeritus of Down East Magazine. The Bone Orchard, the 5th book in the Mike Bowditch series, did I pronounce that right?
You did.
Comes out July 15th, 2014. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Is that one in yet, or are you finishing it up?
Oh, it's, it's never done until it's done. Yeah, there's a moment where you actually get the printed book and you can't quite believe it's real.
But they have a date, July 15th.
Yes.
So at what point are you allowed to stop tinkering?
I don't know, actually.
You're going to press them on that one?
there's been times where right up to the 11th hour, you discover something that's just a horrible mistake and you have to see if you can kind of get a fix in, but
stop the press.
Stop the press.
Because
absolutely.
If you don't, your readers will let you know.
They will let you know. Yes. Specifically, if anything that has to do with firearms or the military.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
or cars.
Or cars. True.
So just avoid all three and you'll be all set, right? We're going to go to Hilda in Harpswell. Hi, Hilda. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I'm really glad you keep giving the number because I was flipping through pages of experience trying to find where the number might be, and then you gave it again. So thank you. I just want to let you know that when I first actually moved to Maine with my family, I was about 10, and I was a good reader, and I loved Dickens. I couldn't get more nasty than some of his stories, and I thought those were pretty horrible. But I moved into Kittery, Maine, Kittery Point, and the big thing there was, of course, you respected authors along with everybody else, and it was Celia Thaxter's Murder on Smutty Nose, which creeped me out completely. I could hardly go swimming the first summer. But then we all sort of guessed how hard it would be to row from Portsmouth out to the island.
That's a long haul.
But the other thing that got me was when I came back after years being away to Maine again, and we moved into the Orono area, and, of course, everybody wanted to loan me their Stephen King. And from then on, I couldn't walk straight up because I had to examine all the sewers in Bangor. It's been kind of an experience, and I do enjoy mysteries. And I like to read ancient ones about nuns solving crimes in ancient times, and I bring them up to date with London crime. And I really appreciate this program. Thank you very much for fielding questions and making comments.
Well, thanks so much, Hilda. You know, I have to confess I can't read Stephen King because I like to sleep at night. I'm serious. I really like a good night's sleep. I don't want to wake up and listen to every noise differently. But you all probably enjoy that, waking up in the middle of the night and wondering what that noise is.
Well, and as professional writers, too, I mean, we all live in the shadow of Stephen King. I mean, I know people – I've met people as I've traveled overseas who know absolutely nothing about the state of Maine other than the fact that Stephen King lives here.
And then they ask you.
And then they ask
you. Know Stephen King? Because we live in Maine. Everybody
we
knows
all know each other.
Yeah.
Well, we kind of do.
Well, and what's interesting about that, too, is I grew up reading King. I think the first grown-up book I ever read was The Tommyknockers, and I picked it up off a shelf because it was the single largest book I'd ever seen in my life to that point, and I thought, I need to know what's in there. Mm-hmm. I did not, at the age of 11, need to know what was in there, as it turns out. But what's interesting is, as somebody who's not from the state of Maine, my wife's a native Mainer, but I'm from upstate New York, I felt like I knew the place before I'd ever come up here. And when I first came up to visit her in college, I was driving up, and I remember, I can't remember where on the turnpike I was, but I smelled this smell, this god-awful reek of a smell, and I thought, that's a paper mill. And I knew because I'd read so much King.
It had been described so well.
It had.
Yeah, that's really something. Going to Peter in Portland. Hi, Peter.
Oh, hi, guys. I'm enjoying this program immensely. And I wanted to clear up one little bit of confusion about the Dutch-born writer who lived in Maine. It was Jan Willem de Wettering. Spelled with a W, the Wettering. But my question for the panel is your favorite movies based on crime novels. I just watched, my wife Terry and I just watched, for a second time, Devil in a Blue Dress. Fantastic movie based on the Walter Mosley novel with Denzel Washington. And, of course, there's the Maltese Falcon. L.A. Confidential is super good. But what does the panel think?
Ooh,
any thoughts?
Yeah, because I love crime fiction movies. But, you know, I can't think of any the sort of book to movies that are my favorites, partially because if I read something, I tend to be super picky about what I see on the screen. But I love watching caper movies, which you don't see as many novels now, crime fiction novels coming out in the caper genre. But my husband and I just streamed all three of the Oceans movies, you know, anything that involves a gang trying to tunnel under a bank. Yeah, I'm there. I'm right
well,
there.
Well, George Clooney, too.
Yeah, yeah, that helps, too.
Well, I don't think you get any better than Double Indemnity, personally. You know, I mean, it's James M. Cain wrote the book and Raymond Chandler wrote the screenplay. I mean, that's like, you know, as good as it gets.
Agreed. That would have been my choice. It's a perfect, perfect movie.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Peter, thanks for calling and hi. Going to Jane in Rockland. Hi, Jane. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon. Most of the movies that I enjoy are old movies, or they're pre-electronic device movies. And the books that I read are also pre-electronic device books. It seems to me that so many plots and situations could not happen given electronic technology, if that was inserted. And I wonder how you address, how the writers address plots thickening when there is instant communication and photographs and all of that stuff instantly available. Does that impact the writing?
Good question.
You know, I think the answer to that is often badly. we writers have a couple of tropes that we tend to lean on when it comes to electronic devices. I can't tell you how many dead zones I've seen in books and horror movies where people just can't seem to get a bar on their cell phone. I actually think that the presence or absence of these devices is sort of value neutral. There's got to be a good way to use them. And you see in certain conspiracy thrillers where the travel of information actually becomes part of the story in an interesting way. But you're absolutely right. It's a difficult thing to grapple with. And as somebody who loves classic pulp fiction and classic caper stories, it very much changes the landscape. And it means that a lot of those influences of mine aren't really that relevant when you're trying to come up with a story in modern times.
Do all three of you place your novels in modern times, all of your novels, or have you done both?
Mine are all set. Well, it's sort of mod. They started out in exactly the same date when I started writing them, but the time has outstripped my actual production, so I think I'm up to 2006. But yeah, there's cell phones are a problem. As a matter of fact, I actually ran into this directly. My first book, In the Bleak Midwinter, came out in 2002, but I wrote it, I finished it in 2000. I wrote most of it in 99. And not only did I not have a cell phone until 2003, but most of the people that I knew here in Maine did not have cell phones back in 2000 because you couldn't get a signal anywhere unless you were right on certain spots in the coast or in Portland. And I will occasionally get emails from readers who, of course, are reading it in 2013 or 2014, and they say, well, this is idiotic. How come she just didn't whip out her cell phone and call? It's like, well, you know, yeah, I got caught in the gap there, the technological gap.
Well, it's funny. Do you try to be super realistic? Because I've noticed often, you know, you think of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, to Peter brought up movies. You know, why is she walking up the stairs? You know, dummy, don't walk up the stairs. You know, I mean, do you allow yourself to let your characters do a few things that really aren't quite so bright to move the story along? Or do you really try to be smart about it?
Well, I think you have to grant yourself a certain amount of poetic license. I mean, you know, people are reading you for the story and they're willing to give you a certain amount of rope, you know. But I write about the Maine Warden Service and do my best to convey how they investigate crimes. And, you know, again, the technology keeps changing from year to year to year. And the book that I'm currently working on has to do with searching for missing hikers. And so I'm drawing a lot on it's not based on the search for Geraldine Largay, who was the woman who disappeared on the AT south of Sugarloaf, but the technological devices that were used to try to pin her down from her, you know, using her cell phone is really interesting. And it's really important, I think, if when you're telling these stories, you know, in fact, to me, actually, one of the things that I see is that I believe a lot of fiction has sort of chickened out in terms of dealing with technology, because it's hard to write about, say, television. You know, television doesn't make for great plots, but we all know that if there, you know, when there's a prominent murder, it's all over television. You know, it's part of the investigation. What's leaking out? You know, is the father of the missing girl talking to the press? You know, and what is he saying? And what is the mother saying? You know, and do these things differ? And it seems to me to be sort of dishonest and, quite frankly, you know, cowardly to not try to reckon with the impact that technology has on our lives if you're writing in the present day. And I think that's why you see so many historical books, is that you just say, I can't deal with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That actually makes me think, as a sideline on that, something that I think I read somewhere, which is that one of the things that crime fiction does that a lot of other fiction does not is deal with people at work. Crime fiction is almost innately about people doing their jobs. Either they are professionals, like, you know, Mike Bowditch, that's his job, is to go out and track down criminals. Or because of their job, they wind up getting drawn into it. My lead character is an Episcopal priest, and she gets drawn into it because she is doing the work that she's supposed to do. And it's interesting because when you really start to think about it, you think, yeah, that's true. You don't see a lot of straight-up literary fiction that is primarily set in workplaces, and it's the whole focus is about people going about their jobs.
Okay, I want to go to a tweet. Please ask each author what they're reading these days.
So I actually just finished a fantastic thriller by the name of Brilliance yesterday by Marcus Seki. It's a wonderful novel. It's got a slight science fiction bent, but it's a straightforward thriller, and it's just a marvelous read. And then as soon as I sat that down, I picked up Queenpin by Megan Abbott, who's a terrific modern noir writer. She wrote my favorite book of last year, in Dare Me, which was a modern noir that took place entirely on a high school cheer squad.
Ha!
And Queenpin is actually a period piece, but it's a wonderful book so far.
Okay, so we'll have to get those up on our Facebook page. How about you, Julia?
I'm going to be talking and doing some teaching at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, with a friend of mine, William Kent Krueger. And so to prep for that, I've been rereading his Corcoran series.
Cork O'Connor.
Cork O'Connor series. I love these books and I never get it out right. Kent Krueger, that's what you need to remember that.
Okay.
So I love them.
Okay. And what about you, Paul?
I'm going to go at this the opposite way, which is that as a writer, one of the things you have to do is research. And so I'm actually the book that I just finished and I'm recommending to everybody is a book by a guy named Jim Sterba, who has a place in Southwest Harbor, and it's called Nature Wars. And it's about the impact of the reforestation of primarily of the eastern United States on our lives. And one of the chapters has to deal with the invasion of coyotes into the northeastern United States, and that's going to figure into my next book. So those of you who follow Mike Bowditch might want to know that you're going to see some coyotes.
And that's great because we've had Jim Sterba on the program. He was terrific, very popular guest, and wonderful man. So, hey, you guys, this was really fun. Thank you so much for joining us today. Julia Spencer Fleming's most recent novel is Through the Evil Days. Chris F. Holm is an award-winning short story writer. His critically acclaimed collector novels recast the battle between heaven and hell as old-fashioned crime pulp. Paul Dworin is editor emeritus of Down East Magazine. The Bone Orchard, the fifth book in the Mike Bowditch series, comes out July 15th, 2014. Also, the first book in the Bowditch series, The Poacher's Son, will be the subject of this month's Maine Calling Book Club, which will take place April 24th. That means you have time to read it. Don't forget that next Saturday, April 19th, is the inaugural Maine Writer and Publishers Alliance Maine Crime Wave Conference. Visit the Maine Calling Facebook page for more details about that. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board, and we had additional help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. You can also find our podcasts on iTunes. Tomorrow on the program, join host Keith Shortall for a conversation about C-sections, home deliveries, and issues surrounding childbirth. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.